research I've been doing, and I feel compelled to interrupt. 9600 BC, that's not just the end of the Ice Age, it's the end of the Younger Dryas cold spell that starts in what, 10800 BC? And ends in 9620 BC, Schmidt continues, according to the ice cores from Greenland. So how likely is it to be an accident that the monumental phase at Göbekli Tepe starts in 9600 BC, when the climate of the whole world has taken a sudden turn for the better, and there's an explosion in nature and in possibilities? I can only agree. It doesn't seem likely that it's an accident at all. On the contrary, I feel certain there must be a connection. We'll explore that connection, and the mysterious cataclysmic period that geologists call the Younger Dryas, and what those Greenland ice cores tell us, in part two. Meanwhile, back in 2013, I closed my interview with Klaus Schmidt with some praise. And in December 2014, as I sit at my desk, going through the transcript of the recording I made at Göbekli Tepe, and knowing that Klaus died of a massive, unexpected heart attack on 20 July 2014, I'm glad I did so. You're a very humble man, I say, but the fact is you've discovered a site that has caused all of us to rethink our ideas of the past. This is a remarkable thing, and I believe that your name, as well as the name of Göbekli Tepe, will go down in history. The Bringers of Civilization. After leaving Göbekli Tepe in mid-September 2013, I make an extensive journey through the length and breadth of Turkey before I finally return home. The Lion Pillar sticks in my mind, but what particularly haunts me is the scene on pillar number 43 in Enclosure D, the scene showing the vulture with its bent, human-like knees and its wing that so much resembles an arm, holding up a solid disc. I download Santa's photographs onto my computer and call up that scene. It has many remarkable elements as well as the disc. Both wings of the vulture are shown, I now realize, the other stretched out behind its body. To the right of the vulture is a serpent. It has a large triangular head, as do all serpents depicted at Göbekli Tepe, and its body is coiled into a curve, with its tail extending down towards an H-shaped pictogram. The serpent is nestled close to another large bird, not a vulture, but something more like an ibis with a long, sickle-shaped beak. Between it and the vulture is yet another bird, again with a hooked beak, but smaller, with the look of a chick. I turn my attention to the disc. I don't know what to make of it, but the obvious guess from its shape is that it's meant to represent the sun. There's something else that interests me more, however, if I can just put my finger on what it is. Something evocative, something hauntingly familiar about the imagery of this ancient pillar from Göbekli Tepe. Santa has shot hundreds of frames of it, from every possible angle, and obsessively I keep going through them, hoping for some clue. The vulture, the disc, and in the next register above the vulture, that weird row of bags with their curved handles. Bags. Handbags. Suddenly I get it. I go to the shelf in my library where I keep reference copies of my own books, pull out Fingerprints of the Gods and start leafing through the photo sections. The first section deals with South America, and what I'm looking for isn't there, but the second section is devoted to Mexico, and on the fifth page, I find it. It's image number 33 with the caption, "Man in Serpent Sculpture from the Olmec site of La Venta." It's Santa's photograph, taken way back in 1992 or 1993, of an impressive relief, carved on a slab of solid granite measuring about 1.2 meters, 4 feet wide, and 1.5 meters, 5 feet high. The relief features what is believed to be the earliest representation of the Central American deity whom the Maya, a later civilization than the Olmecs, would call Kukulkan or Gucumatz, and who was known by the even later Aztecs as Quetzalcoatl. All three names mean feathered serpent, sometimes translated as plumed serpent. And it is such a serpent, decorated with a prominent feathered crest on its head, that we see here. Its powerful body coils sinuously around the outer edge of the relief, cradling the figure of a man, who is depicted in a seated position, as though he's reaching for petals with his feet. In his right hand, he's holding what I described at the time as a small, bucket-shaped object. I return to Santa's images from Enclosure D at Göbekli Tepe, and am immediately able to confirm what I suspected, The three bags on the pillar closely resemble the bucket-shaped object from La Venta in Mexico. The same curved handle is there in both cases, and the profile of the bags and of the bucket, slightly wider at the bottom than at the top, is also very similar. If that were all there was to it, this would surely be a coincidence. The man in serpent relief from La Venta is thought by archaeologists to date to the period between the 10th and the 6th centuries BC, about 9,000 years younger than the imagery from Göbekli Tepe. So how could there possibly be a connection? That's when I remember a second curious image I reproduced in Fingerprints of the Gods. I check the index for the name Oannes, turn to chapter 11, and find another figure of a man carrying a bag or bucket. I hadn't noticed the resemblance between it and man in serpent before, but it's obvious to me now. Although not absolutely identical, both bags have the same curved handle that is also depicted on the Göbekli Tepe pillar. Quickly, I scan through the report I wrote 20 years earlier. Oannes was a civilizing hero, revered by all the ancient cultures of Mesopotamia. He was said to have appeared there in the remotest antiquity and to have taught the inhabitants the skills necessary for writing and for doing mathematics and for all sorts of knowledge, how to build cities, found temples, make laws, determine borders and divide land, also how to plant seeds and then to harvest their fruits and vegetables. In short, he taught men all those things conducive to a civilized life. The fullest account we have of Oannes is found in surviving fragments of the works of a Babylonian priest called Berossus, who wrote in the 3rd century BC. Fortunately, I have a translation of all the Berossus fragments in one volume in my library, so I dig it out, along with a few other sources on ancient Mesopotamian myths and traditions. It doesn't take me long to discover that Oannes did not do his work alone, but was supposedly the leader of a group of beings known as the Seven Apkalu, the Seven Sages, who were said to have lived before the Flood. A cataclysmic global deluge features prominently in many Mesopotamian traditions, including those of Sumer, Akkad, Assyria, and Babylon. Alongside Oannes, these sages are portrayed as bringers of civilization who, in the most ancient past, gave humanity a moral code, arts, crafts, and agriculture, and taught them architectural, building, and engineering skills. That's a list, I can't help thinking, that includes all the skills supposedly invented at Göbekli Tepe. I call up a map on my computer screen and see that not only does southeastern Turkey adjoin Mesopotamia geographically, but also that the two areas are linked in an even more intimate and direct way. Largely occupied today by the modern state of Iraq, the ancient name Mesopotamia means literally land between rivers, the rivers in question being the Tigris and the Euphrates, which reach the sea in the Persian Gulf, but which both have their headwaters in the same Taurus mountain range of southeastern Turkey, where Göbekli Tepe is situated. While I'm online, I run some searches for images of the Seven Sages. I don't get many hits at first, but the moment I change the search terms to Apkalu and Seven Apkalu, I open a colossal archive of images from all over the internet, many of them reliefs from Assyria, a culture that thrived in Mesopotamia from approximately 2500 BC to about 600 BC. I add Assyrian Apkalu to the search parameters, and even more images flood my screen. Often they show bearded men holding bags or buckets, which closely resemble those depicted on the Göbekli Tepe pillar and the one held by the Mexican man in serpent figure. It's not just the curved handles of these containers or their shape, where the resemblance is much closer than on the original Oannes relief I reproduced in Fingerprints of the Gods. Even more striking is the peculiar and distinctive way that the figures from both Mesopotamia and Mexico hold these containers with the fingers of the hands turned inwards and the thumb crooked forwards over the handle. There's something else as well. A good number of the images show not a man, but a therianthrope, a birdman, with a hooked beak exactly like the hooked beak of the therianthrope on the Göbekli Tepe pillar. What makes the resemblance even closer is that in the Mesopotamian reliefs, the birdman is holding the container in one hand and a cone-shaped object in the other. The shape is a little different, but a comparison with the disc cradled above the wing of the Göbekli Tepe birdman is hard to resist. I can't prove anything yet. It could, of course, all be coincidence, or I could be imagining links that aren't there. But my curiosity is aroused by the similar containers on different continents in different epochs, and so I jot down a series of questions that can form the frame of a loose hypothesis for future testing. For instance, could these containers, whether they're bags or buckets, be the symbols of office of an initiatic brotherhood, far-traveled and deeply ancient, with roots reaching back into the remotest prehistory? I feel that this possibility, extraordinary though it may seem on the face of things, is worth looking into, and is strengthened by the distinctive hand postures. Might these not have served the same sort of function as Masonic handshakes today, providing an instant means of identifying who is an insider and who is not? And what might have been the purpose of such a brotherhood? Curiously enough, in both Mexico and Mesopotamia, where myths and traditions have survived in connection with the imagery and symbolism, we are left in no doubt as to what the purpose was. Stated simply, it was to teach, to guide, and to spread the benefits of civilization. This, after all, was the explicit function of Oannes and the Apkallu sages, who taught the inhabitants of Mesopotamia how to plant seeds and then to harvest their fruits and vegetables, agriculture in other words, and who also taught them architectural and engineering skills, notably the building of temples. If they needed to be taught these things, then they must have had no knowledge of them before the arrival of the sages. They must, in other words, have been nomadic hunter-gatherers, just as the inhabitants of southeastern Turkey were until the sudden and surprising entry onto the world stage of Göbekli Tepe. The same, it transpires, was believed to be the case with the ancient inhabitants of Mexico before the arrival of Quetzalcoatl, the feathered serpent, who came to teach them the benefits of settled agriculture and the skills necessary to build temples. Although this deity is frequently depicted as a serpent, he is more often shown in human form, the serpent being his symbol and his alter ego, and is usually described as a tall, bearded, white man, a mysterious person, a white man with a strong formation of body, broad forehead, large eyes, and a flowing beard. Indeed, as Sylvanus Griswold Morley, the doyen of Mayan studies, concluded, the attributes and life history of Quetzalcoatl are so human that it is not improbable that he may have been an actual historical character, the memory of whose benefactions lingered after his death, and whose personality was eventually deified. The same could very well be said of Oannes, and just like Oannes at the head of the Apkallu, likewise depicted as prominently bearded, it seems that Quetzalcoatl traveled with his own brotherhood of sages and magicians. We learn that they arrived in Mexico from across the sea in a boat that moved by itself without paddles, and that Quetzalcoatl was regarded as having been the founder of cities, the framer of laws, and the teacher of the calendar. The 16th century Spanish chronicler, Bernardino de Sahagún, who was fluent in the language of the Aztecs and took great care to record their ancient traditions accurately, tells us further that Quetzalcoatl was a great civilizing agent who entered Mexico at the head of a band of strangers. He imported the arts into the country and especially fostered agriculture. He built spacious and elegant houses and inculcated a type of religion which fostered peace. So in summary, as well as a complex pattern of shared symbols and iconography, Quetzalcoatl and Oannes shared the same civilizing mission, which they delivered in widely separated regions of the world, in an epoch that is always described as being very far back in time, remote, antediluvian, and hoary with age. Could it have been as far back as 9600 BC? The epoch of Göbekli Tepe, where many of the same symbols are found, and where, although we have no surviving legends, the signs of a civilizing mission in the form of the sudden appearance of agriculture and monumental architecture are everywhere to be seen. The implications, should I ever be able to prove this hypothesis, are stunning. At the very least, it would mean that some as yet unknown and unidentified people, somewhere in the world, had already mastered all the arts and attributes of a high civilization more than 12,000 years ago, in the depths of the last ice age, and had sent out emissaries around the world to spread the benefits of their knowledge. Who might these shadowy emissaries have been? These sages, these magicians of the gods, as I was already beginning to think of them. And why was there this insistent connection to the date of 9600 BC? For as Klaus Schmidt rightly pointed out as he showed me round Göbekli Tepe under the baking sun of the Taurus Mountains, 9600 BC is indeed an important date. Important not only because it marks the end of the Ice Age, but for another rather surprising reason as well. The Greek lawmaker Solon visited Egypt in 600 BC, and there he was told a very extraordinary story by the priests at the Temple of Sais in the Nile Delta, a story that was eventually handed down to his more famous descendant Plato, who in due course shared it with the world in his dialogues of Timaeus and Critias. It is, of course, the story of the great lost civilization called Atlantis, swallowed up by flood and earthquake in a single terrible day and night, 9,000 years before the time of Solon, or, in our calendar, in 9600 BC. Chapter 2. The Mountain of Light. Everything we've been taught about the origins of civilization may be wrong, says Danny Hillman Natwijaja, PhD, senior geologist with the Research Center for Geotechnology at the Indonesian Institute of Sciences. Old stories about Atlantis and other great lost civilizations of prehistory, long dismissed as myths by archaeologists, look set to be proved true. It's December 2013. We're in Shanzhou Regency, about 900 meters, 2,950 feet above sea level, and 70 kilometers, 43 miles, west of the city of Bandung on the island of Java, Indonesia. I'm climbing with Dr. Natwijaja up the steep slope of a 110-meter, 360-foot-high step pyramid set amidst a magical landscape of volcanoes, mountains, and jungles, interspersed with paddy fields and tea plantations. In 1914, lying scattered amongst the dense trees and undergrowth that then covered the summit of the pyramid, ancient man-made structures formed from blocks of columnar basalt were first shown to archaeologists. Local people held the site to be sacred and called it Gunung Padang, the name it still goes by today, often mistranslated as Mountain Field by those unaware that the language of this area is not Indonesian but Sundanese, in which Gunung Padang means Mountain of Light or Mountain of Enlightenment. The structures were found to be arranged across five terraces with a combined area of about 150 meters, 492 feet long, by 40 meters, 131 feet wide. The visiting archaeologists were told that the terraces had been used as a place of meditation and retreat since time immemorial, and again, this remains true today. However, neither the archaeologists nor apparently the locals realized the pyramid was a pyramid. It was believed to be a natural hill, somewhat modified by human activity, until Natwijaja and his team began a geophysical survey here in 2011 using ground-penetrating radar, electrical resistivity, and seismic tomography. By then, the summit had long since been cleared, and the structures on the terraces recognized as works of megalithic architecture. But no radiocarbon dating had yet been done, and the age attributed to the site, about 1000 BC, was based on guesswork rather than on excavations. The first scientific radiocarbon dating was done by Natwijaja himself on organic materials in soils underlying the megaliths at or near the surface. The dates produced, around 500 to 1500 BC, were close enough to the archaeological guesswork to cause no controversy. But a surprise was in store as Natwijaja and his team extended their investigation using tubular drills that brought up cores of earth and stone from much deeper levels. First, the drill cores contained evidence, fragments of worked columnar basalt, that more man-made megalithic structures lay far beneath the surface. Secondly, the organic materials brought up in the drill cores began to yield older and older dates. 3000 BC to 5000 BC, then 9600 BC as the drills bit deeper.